Conference record has joined the conference.
Well, good evening, everyone. We've got quite a nice group here this evening, and I'm so happy that this has been a topic of interest for many of you who are joining the call. Tonight we're talking about goals and objectives in the IEP, and we're very happy that Kathy Harstead is going to be presenting that to us from the Pathfinder Center. The PowerPoint presentation that I did send to you, I'm going to resend to all of you following the call that have registered. Some of the pictures were not really clearly defined in the one that I sent you, so I have a new one to send you, thanks to Kathy, who helped me straighten that out, converting it into a PDF. So be looking for that in your email accounts. So without further ado, Kathy, welcome, and thank you for coming tonight to talk about goals and objectives.
Thanks, Denine. I'm really excited to be here, everyone, and I would like to say that we want this to be interactive, so if you have questions or key thoughts to share as we go, you know, feel free to do that, and to know that you can, your comments can be anonymous, that, you know, what it says here stays here until the recording's put up on the web when everyone hears it. I'm just kidding. But, you know, you can always contact me afterwards, too, if you have another question. Just a little bit of background. I have a master's degree in special education and worked as a teacher for 6 years with a lot of different students. And then I spent 15 years working in adult services where I got to write more goals and objectives. Zillions, and spent hours and hours in meetings, and I've done quite a bit of research for this today just to bring you the best information that I can. And I'm really going to talk about this from parent perspective in terms of getting the best services that you can for your child. And so let's get started. I'll just go on to my first slide, and when you get the clear pictures, you'll see two adorable little stick figure people who are trying to put together something with a lot of yeses and nos and struggling. And I would like to say that writing measurable goals is not necessarily always easy. It can get complicated, and teaching ourselves or learning how to do it well takes a bit of knowledge and some practice. At the same time, if you slip on to the next slide, writing goals is also sometimes feels elusive, like reaching for that bubble, because we're not just talking about writing goals as an intellectual exercise. We're talking about writing goals that are pivotal, that make a difference, that are meaningful, and that really move our child's learning along. And so there's a lot at stake for all of us, for educators who want to do a good job in providing special ed services, and for parents who want to see their child progress and learn at school. So in slide four, some of us have looked at our IEPs, giving it our best efforts, and have looked back at goals or objectives that were written into plans and realized that what we really ended up with was something called gobbledygook, or gobbledygook. And so I did a little humor here with my team is having trouble thinking outside the box. We can't agree on the size of the box, what materials the box should be constructed from, a reasonable budget for the box, or our first choice of box vendors. And while that's kind of a business cartoon, it makes the point that goals don't just spring up, you know, suddenly intact. They come out of the team planning process, and if we're having trouble with that, we're going to end up with goals that just really aren't measurable or don't advance the learning for our child. And that's not what we all want. So going on to slide five, I think it's important to get to the basics right away. Annual goals must relate specifically to the needs identified in the present level or the present level of functioning in the IEP. Now, when I first read that or heard that statement, which really comes right out of IDEA, I didn't really know everything that was behind all of those words, but and as a special education teacher, the initial way that I was taught to write present levels of functioning is not really how it was required in the law. And so I had to learn how to change that over time. And even today, I will often see present levels of functioning written into the IEP, and they're really long rehashes of all the evaluations with a lot of developmental information in them. And while that's not necessarily bad, because sometimes that information from the evaluation is critical to the team in planning, you can write all that in and actually not include a present level of functioning. And I'll talk more about what that means in just a minute. So it's important as we look at our IEPs to make sure that what we put under the present level of functioning really is how that student is functioning, both academic and functionally. And there isn't a lot of guidance out there for special educators in how to do that, but CEC, the Council for Exceptional Children, and other groups have put together protocols, and many units will try to follow those. So our goals have to relate to the present level of functioning and to the needs identified. And you can put a lot of information, again, into that, but not really identify what the student needs as a result of their disabilities. What specifically kinds of specialized instruction do they need? What accommodations and modifications do they need? But also, what do they need to help them benefit from education? And the other things is that, of course, our goals need to include statements that are observable and measurable based on some kind of standard about what it is that students ought to be learning and linked to that grade level standard. We'll be talking more about that. And then a goal must describe what a student can reasonably accomplish within a 12-month period. Because, and that becomes really critical because we want to be able to go back at any time during the year and see the rate of progress toward achieving that goal. And sometimes we set benchmarks or partway points leading to the goal. Now, we titled this presentation Writing Goals and Objectives, but actually in the law you do not have to write objectives any longer. And it is all right to write benchmarks, and sometimes, depending on how broad the goal is, that is really helpful. There's nothing illegal about writing objectives, and many teams in North Dakota continue to do that, but strictly speaking, it's not required. We've gone to more of a focus on goals with some benchmarks as kind of how it's described in the law currently. So there's nothing wrong with doing objectives. You can continue if you want to, but you don't have to as a team. All right, next slide. So, okay, it can be complicated, and there's something about present level and measurability and yada, yada, yada. So where do we want to start? I find that a lot of that falls away from me when I walk into that team meeting. I have come with a list of things I kind of want to get, and, you know, I don't have Kathy's little slide presentation up there when I'm in that team meeting. So how do you do this? How do you remember? And so I wanted to just focus on three key ideas that I'm hoping will stick in your brain. And even though you can't see the pictures, which look beautiful when they're done right, we have a drop of water dropping into the lake and then creating ripples. And that's what a good goal should do. It really should have an impact that from those goals, our children really start to thrive and succeed. That's what we want to get to. So the first drop is who. So we'll look at the next slide, and I just threw in some different photos of kids with special needs. The goals need to be individualized for our child. And I want to talk specifically about something that is available called, sometimes they're called goal banks or IEP goal banks. And you can look on the internet and find these. And sometimes schools use them. And what they are is there'll be a list of standards that kids are supposed to meet, and then underneath them they'll have sample goals. And goal banks are kind of good and bad all at the same time. They're good in the sense that sometimes you can look at those and you get some really great ideas that you might not have thought of wording a goal that way, and you might read one and go, oh, that really would fit my child. They're bad in the sense that IEPs need to be individualized for your child, and just picking goals out of a bank at large doesn't really tie them back to the evaluations, and it doesn't really tie them back to your child's unique needs. So they're a powerful tool to get ideas from, but they shouldn't really be used to lead the team process, and we have to be careful with them, is what I would say. So when you walk into that meeting, you want to walk in with, in the front of your mind, who your child is as not just a great person or a great kid, because we all have great kids, but as a learner who is preparing to someday be as independent a person as possible and prepared to work and be a lifelong learner. And thinking ahead is not always easy with our kids. We're often just caught up in the day-to-day. I think as parents, just trying to get through the day, get through the routine. I mean, we can't see around the curve in the road, but we do know who our children are, and the older they get, the more clear that becomes to us, and we can really begin to individualize their education. It's an exciting process. Okay, let's go back to present levels of functioning. Under IDEA 2004, the IEP must include a statement of the child's present levels of academic achievement and functional performance. And those require objective data from the assessment. So things like this child is a pretty good reader, or this child has, you know, is doing well in math, are not really telling you where that child is performing. What we want to know is, what are those child's skills in reading and math and other key subject areas related to their peers? But we also want to know what their strengths are and what they are able to do. We don't want a laundry list of what they can't do, because it doesn't really help us write a plan. And sometimes evaluations can sound like that to us parents, that I hear this a lot. I went to a meeting and they told me all the things my child can't do, and I left feeling so depressed. But to individualize an educational plan for a child, we really need to build on their strengths and to have that objective data information. So if you read the present level of functioning and it's a lot of descriptors and information about your child, but it doesn't really tell where they're functioning in those subject areas, then it's a rehash of the evaluations, but it doesn't really have the present level of functioning. And without it, and without clear statements about what your child needs, you can't really write good measurable goals. So this isn't just a lot of language I'm saying. It's something that's really critical to the heart of good plans for kids. I'm going on to slide 9. We want to know how the student is performing related to the standards for the student's enrolled grade and what the student needs logically to learn next. And if you go to the website, which I'm just sorry I didn't put it right here on the slide, but we can send it to you if you don't, if you're not familiar with it. If you go to the Department of Public Instruction, if you Google that and look under special education, actually, no, I think you look under regular education for the standards. You can find the standards for different grade levels in North Dakota in math, in reading, in science. in all of the core subject areas. And you can look that up before the meeting and say to yourself, okay, this is what other kids this age are learning about. These are the kinds of learning experiences that the regular curriculum is going to provide. Okay, how does this relate to my child, and where are they performing in relationship to this? And there are also, even if there's a significant gap between those standards and where your child is performing, there are alternate standards that kind of have, where they have looked at the standards and said, okay, this is it in its advanced or proficient form, but what is the key underlying concept or idea here? And they've written what I would call simpler standards that are based in the grade standards. And you can look at those as well under the alternate assessment section. So it's interesting. We tend to, as parents, go in to an IEP meeting focused on what we want for our child without really the sense that a reg ed teacher might have about what other kids are going to be exposed to this year and be learning. And that tends to result in learning gaps that get wider and wider. So it's standard-based planning is really kind of important for us. I'm going to show you now some examples of goals that where, where they looked at the academic performance of kids as a team, and then they made sure that present level of performance included some need statements. Okay, so John is reading at material out of the third grade curriculum with 100% comprehension, and he's able to do that independently. Okay. But in math, John is struggling with X, Y, and Z. He can do this, and this, but he needs to learn whatever it is he needs to learn next. And from there, we have to write need statements. But we want to write those statements in a way that is strengths-based. For one thing, we get enough of what our kids' weaknesses are. But also, it's those strengths that are going to be the pivotal areas that will help them succeed in life and that are a foundation for teaching them. And these strength-based kinds of need statements make it easier from these to write a goal. So if you have a clear idea what your kid needs, then you can write what the goal is. So let's take a look at these. So to develop friendships with classmates which carry over to neighborhood activities. Okay. So if that's what Mary needs, then what's it going to take for that to happen? From this needs statement, we can go ahead and craft a goal for her. John needs to improve reading skills so he can continue to grow as a reader and use it throughout his life. On 11, I have some more examples. To know what will happen during the day so she'll feel calm. You could add, and can benefit from education. To use the computer to help with writing skills. To meet grade level academic standards for science. To build a broad base of knowledge. I then listed some things of what not to do in terms of writing about our kids' needs. Needs to sit still. Needs to keep his hands to himself. Needs to read better. Needs to listen better. These kind of need statements don't really lend themselves to writing a goal. You end up writing a goal for your kid to sit still, but that doesn't really, that's a means to an end. Why do we want them to sit still? Because we want them to be able to benefit from learning activities with other kids as part of a learning community. Or we want them to being able to be an independent learner. And study projects at school that interest them. There's a lot of reasons why kids need to sit still, but just writing this in terms of what's wrong with kids doesn't really get us to very good goals. even needs one-to-one speech therapy. Why? That is still a service that a kid might need, but for what reason? We need to say, you know, so that they can communicate with teachers and peers about everyday events in their lives. And then we have something we can put a goal on. Because you can't really write a goal from needs one-to-one speech therapy. That might be a service. And it's okay to include that in the IEP. I don't want to mislead you, but our goals need to be more focused. And I often hear this from not only from families, but from teachers as well. There are so many things for children to learn. You know, how do you choose which goals to work on? And you get there from those need statements. So going back to slide 11, these kinds of statements in slides 9, 10, and 11 will allow you to then write a goal. So just to review, we have all the evaluations with everything they say about our child, and that includes our own input into that process because we know our children really, really well. And from those, we want to describe how they're performing in academic and functional areas for their grade level, and then what they need as a result of that. We want it to be as respectful and as strengths-based as possible. Oh, I had one more example on slide 13. To improve speech in order to talk. There we go. So that was my example for that. I'm not going to read those to you. You can read those. So I think it's key for the whole team to really, you know, often people will say, well, here is a copy of the present level of functioning from last year. They might do that a little differently if it's the first IEP. Does anybody have any changes? You know, and that doesn't really pull out what the needs are and help us to write goals in itself. We really want to do something in the process to highlight those needs. And because we can add those as a team if they're not in there. What does this student need to access the general education curriculum? What does this student need to participate in the learning process? And what does the student need to benefit from the instruction that's being given as part of the regular curriculum? So there are many different ways that a team can tackle that. There's no one right way. But going on to slide 15, the team can put together a flyer with pulling out all those need statements and look at them together, or they can put together a PowerPoint to do that. They can just write a checklist on a whiteboard as a team. They can bring photos that highlight the kinds of learning opportunities and skills that a student might need. They can actually use the TINET system to pull up the present level of functioning in the meeting and take a look at that and highlight things or look at that together. And if you're not familiar with that, the TINET system is an online case management system that all educators in North Dakota use and complete to record the IEPs. And some teachers just take care of that behind the scenes. So as a parent, you may never see that. But other teachers pull that right up in the meeting because there are a lot of prompts in the TINET system that help teams learn and plan, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's an effective way to get things done. It saves a lot of paperwork down the road. Let's take a look at slide 17. So I've tried to give you some of the background of what we're doing when we write a goal, and this little framework is something you can copy off and bring to your team meetings because this is fully in compliance with what we need to do for writing IEP goals. We need a time frame. We need to determine a reasonable amount of learning time. It has to be what a student can accomplish within the year, but not all goals are going to take a whole year to accomplish. So you need to set a reasonable time frame depending on what you're looking at. And this is where the real partnership comes in, because as a parent, I don't always know what that should be, but by working together, we can figure it out. we need to incorporate an evidence-based strategy in the next part of the goal would be a condition. So by the first of the year, Mary, using, and then we would describe the strategy, the evidence-based strategy that we're going to use to provide the specialized instruction or to facilitate the learning in some way through accommodations or modifications. And then we have to state exactly what it is that the student will do. This is student behavior, not what the teacher is going to do. And it's not what the student may do or might do. It's what the student will do in measurable terms. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. And then we're going to evaluate that with some criteria for evaluating the behavior and set a level of mastery. So this is kind of an overview, and we'll break this down a little bit in ways that are easier to remember because, again, this is a lot of kind of abstract thinking, and mostly as a parent, I live in an everyday world with my kid. But you can print this off and bring this into the team process with you, and I'm going to give you some other tools as well. Let's go on to slide 18. So I think we've kind of covered this. Another way of talking about the criterion is to say the expected level of performance. This next slide, slide 19, is kind of, again, a little tool that you can take in to help you think about the goals that you're trying to write. So we have two big things that we have to think about. Is this goal that we're going to write, does it address the student's unique needs? And then does the goal prepare the student for work, for independent living, for lifelong learning? And we want to ask ourselves as a team, I'll tell you, you know, it takes a little practice as a team to get to writing good goals. And this is something that educators struggle with as well as parents. I've written 30 gazillion goals in my lifetime, and they haven't all been great. And it took me a while to learn this. And a lot of times what happens in an IEP meeting is we tell a lot of stories, which isn't all bad, and we spend a lot of time building that present level of functioning or reviewing progress. And then we try to write the goals in the last 10 minutes of the meeting. And that doesn't work very well. So we want to ask ourselves, is this goal developmentally appropriate for my child? Yes, it might be a standard for all the kids in the third grade or the fifth grade or middle school or whatever, but where is my child in relationship to this goal, and is it developmentally appropriate for my child? And if not, what is the piece of it that is the next logical thing for my child given where they're functioning? Is this goal meaningful? You know, is it really meaningful for a student to build a two-block tower? Is that going to really help them functionally in life? You know, is, you know, in chatting with some parents the other night, a couple of parents were talking about the fact that, you know, the number of credits that you need to graduate, the number of academic classes that you have to take, keeps going up every year, and so we end up requiring students to take more and more classes to work on the things that they're not good at, and they can't get always the elective courses that they would like to take, especially as they get older, and it makes education seem less meaningful for them. And then sometimes we have problems with students dropping out. So not only does it make sense for the student to be learning, is it going to really help them in life, but is our goal something that our student, you know, our child can identify with? And, you know, the kids don't always know that things we force them to learn, like brushing their teeth or whatever, are meaningful. But still, it's something to be thinking about as our kids get older and they get more involved in the process. Is this approach that we're going to be using, this condition and this way of instructing the kids, is it effective? And, you know, many times for us as parents, we're thinking, well, how would I know? You know, I'm not the special educator here. I rely on the school to do that. But we do know what is effective for our children in a learning process. And we do know that students that get research-based learning strategies used with them do better. We can know that as parents and ask key questions. And usually I find that educators are often just as concerned as I am about this kind of stuff. I don't want to, as a parent, just be pulling any old thing off the internet and saying, this is how I want you to instruct my kid. I really want to know what is going to work with my child and see that evidence-based stuff. And then, is this goal going to be progressive? In other words, is it too little? And if they're not, you know, the gap between their performance and the other kids will just grow with this goal, is it really going to move them along? So there's a lot to think about. Appropriate, meaningful, effective, progressive. Holy crumb, I can barely remember what I had for lunch today, you know? But that's why writing goals gets to be a little bit complicated. And I think that we just have to do the best we can with this and come prepared as we write our goals to think of some of the key questions that go along with these ideas. So, to be appropriate, we have to know what our child can presently do in any given domain, like reading or math, and what would logically be the next step. And that's why we need the regular education teachers at our meetings, because they often have the best information on this. Meaningful. I think I covered that. But these are key questions that you can bring into a meeting with you to ask about the goals, or take out your child's IEP and look at it and ask these questions about the goals. And just see where you fall on that scale. Effective is the next slide. And does the goal incorporate principles of universal design for learning? I'm going to cover that in a little bit. Are we thinking about how this child gets information, how they share information, and how to motivate them in the learning process? Let's see. Okay. So we've covered progressive. I'm going to go ahead and go on to the building blocks. I have, you know, we're on slide 24, and I can't bring 24 slides into the IEP meeting because it would look really weird. So, if I wanted to kind of narrow it down, the building blocks are the time frame, the conditions, the behavior, and the fourth one is the criterion, but that's a big word that I don't use every other day. So I like this one better. I just remember these two things, how well and for how long. If my child gets it once, is that enough to say that they've really got it? How many times would they have to do this, or for how long to reach what they call mastery? And it's important to pay attention to that. I've seen how many, and to really make sure that it makes sense. You know, I've seen goals where somebody is writing that somebody will do something with accuracy when accuracy isn't really the key part of doing that behavior. Doesn't matter, you know, about accuracy. It might matter how long they do something, or the quality, some other way of measuring the quality besides the accuracy. We tend to write accuracy into a lot of goals. Accuracy is fine where it works, but it doesn't work for every single goal, that's all I'm going to say. The next slide is a picture of some of the universal design for learning guidelines, and if you Google that, you'll probably come to the website for CAST, which really is the national center that is is promoting universal design for learning. And so we want to look at multiple means that information can be represented for students, for them to perceive it, for the language and the symbols, and to support comprehension. Multiple ways that the students can express themselves. Do they really need to be able to write this, or can they dictate it into something? Can they? How do they communicate their what they know, really, in a learning situation? And then multiple means of engagement. Those are good pieces to think about as we're writing the behavior and the conditions in our goals. It really opens up the learning experiences for our kids and helps them succeed. I'm going to go on to slide 26. No one has asked me any questions, though, so I'm getting really worried. I don't know if I'm boring you out of your minds or if I'm just talking gobbledygook to people or what questions you have. And since you're such a quiet group, I'm just going to plunge away here, but do stop me and talk about your experiences if you would like, and we can try to make this more real for people. The reason, one of the primary reasons that we write goals is we want our children to make progress. And we can't get anywhere if we don't have a goal. And then we need to measure whether that's happening. But if a child is making progress on his IEP goals, but he's receiving failing grades or he's not making adequate progress in academic areas, it can actually be evidence that the child is not receiving a free, appropriate public education. And I often see this. I'll talk to a parent whose child is in the fifth grade, and they're falling farther and farther behind, but they've been meeting their IEP goal. But those goals were just pulled out by the team from the present level. Well, I think we should work on this, and I think he needs to do more of this, and I definitely think he needs some of this, without really paying attention to what everyone else is learning. And so when it comes to the annual testing that we do in schools now to see if kids are making adequate progress, we get a student who's doing well on their IEP goals, but they're actually falling farther behind in math or reading. And as a member of the IP team, we need to be smarter than that and really make sure that our goals are addressing the full range of learning opportunities that is available to students in school today and what from that is going to be pivotal for our kids. To meet the Free Appropriate Public Education, or FAPE as it's sometimes called, the school must ensure that the child makes adequate progress in academic and functional performance and on the IEP goals. And if the academic achievement and functional performance are not keeping up with the child's progress on their IEP goals, then the child's IEP, that would be a signal to us as a team that, hey, I think we need to go back and look at these goals. Because they're meeting the goals, but, you know, they're not really getting reading in the classroom well. All right. Sometimes for some of our kids, because of their intellectual disabilities, the progress academically is not going to be what their peers are going to make. And we know that. We don't know when our kids are young what their limitations will be. And problems occur when someone else tries to decide what those limitations are. But as our children grow, we do see struggles, and we know from the earlier testing that many of the academic requirements are sometimes going to be too much for our children to do in the full abstract sense. However, that doesn't mean our kids can't learn and that we shouldn't have high standards and that we shouldn't be taking that rich curriculum that's available to them in the general education environment and milking out of that what would be pivotal for our children to learn. And that's not always an easy thing to do it certainly isn't doable if the need statements at the present level of functioning aren't there. And I think it's really important for those of us parents who do have children with more significant cognitive challenges to really talk with other families, talk with educators who work with kids when they're older, and find out of the students that you see succeeding in the world, the students that have good relationships, the students that are working, the students that are curious about life and become lifelong learners. What are some pivotal skills that we should really be focusing on in our child's education in both reading and in math and in science? I know from my own experience as a parent that while not every child can learn to read, reading is a fundamental skill. And my daughter was fortunate enough that we focused on that and she was able to learn it. And that is a skill that she uses every day, and it makes her life so much better. And I've talked to other parents whose kids fall in that moderate range where my kid falls, and in some cases they weren't even provided with reading instruction because someone thought their child couldn't learn to read. And I just, whether it's reading or washing the dishes or counting, whatever it is that the team can think, okay, this is what other students are learning this year. What is the fundamental piece of that? Let's go after that, because I think that's going to be really important. And it goes back to those need statements. So, again, if the present level of functioning talks about how tall our children are and how many trips to the doctor they've made and whether they wear glasses and whether they like animals. I mean, that's great, but that doesn't give us the kind of information we need as a team to really write goals that matter and make a difference. Going on to the next slide, decisions. If we know that a gap cannot be completely closed during an upcoming year, because that's not always possible. If you have a student that's 4 years behind, you're not going to probably close that in a year most of the time. Then what would meaningful progress look like? What would the impact be, and what will it take to do that? And if it's not going to be achievable, is this a student for whom alternate achievement standards make sense in this one area or in this area? So just the next slide, breaking it down, finding that area of need, identifying the content area of the grade level standard, the concepts and prerequisite skills necessary to meet that, the critical attributes or the pieces of that stand of the behavior that will address the standard, and then how we might measure that. So that is basically what it takes to write measurable goals. I'm going to stop at this point and see if we can have a conversation about that. What are you thinking about as you hear all this?
I have a question and a comment.
Okay.
This is Janice. Fabulous presentation, Kathy. I'm very appreciative, and I knew I would be. I'm looking at my son's IEP right now. Can I tell you one of the goals that is really common and the wordage of it?
Sure.
Charlie will initiate communication with a peer and engage by taking at least 3 conversational turns and asking at least 2 questions related to the topic during 1 20-minute session. And that is very common language in every goal that's ever been written. I never understand it. I see. And you've really nailed it with what does that mean for future success? I have never counted any of my other children's conversational turns, and I've never timed them. And this is just very, I've never had anyone talk to me about an IEP goal as specifically as you just did that makes me realize how wasteful this wordage is.
There's nothing wrong with the goal that you have, but it may not meet all of that stuff about being meaningful or progressive. And with just a few tweaks, I bet your team can just put that in more everyday language and shape it to be just a little bit more meaningful, don't you think?
Yeah, it lacks meaning to me now. I can see that we all intended for it to be meaningful, but it isn't.
Well, and as I said, educators struggled with this. I struggled with that, and it's still a challenge, and that's where looking at other examples comes in handy. You don't want to walk into a meeting and find that somebody's planned out all the goals and written them down, and they hand them to you and say, you know, you agree with this, right? That isn't really a good team process, but it can be handy to look at examples and get some different ideas about what's possible.
This is Dion, and I guess I'm in probably a little bit different position because I'm going into my son's first IEP.
Mm-hmm.
And my biggest challenge is when you talk about you know, not only academic goals, but functional goals.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if you can expand on more. One of my biggest concerns, one of my biggest adjustments is, you know, we have functioned under an individual family service plan, you know, because he was diagnosed at birth with Down syndrome. So we have, you know, been completely functionally based up to this point. And I've continued to hear over and over again that, you know, so when we looked at speech, OT, and PT, it has all been functional, you know, functional living skills for him.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm going into IEP, I keep hearing, we've already had one meeting and we're coming into our IEP writing in a week, they talk about the functional skills are only written in IEP if they relate to his academic needs. So I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about that, because I guess I disagree with that kind of thinking, because I think that when you have a child that's three, it's still much more social aspects of functioning that are more critical for them versus solely academic goals.
Right. Well, I'm not aware, and I'm always learning new things, so maybe this will change, but I'm not aware that there's anything an idea that says that we can't write direct functional goals.
Okay.
Say that.
Okay.
But if somebody were to tell me that in a team meeting, I would say, that doesn't make sense to me based on what I've read. Can you show me the basis for that? Where is that coming from? What's the basis for that decision? That's a respectful of trying to get at that.
Right.
To get back to your, the bigger question is, when we think about academic skills, I really think that they should be functional for all of us. I mean, if we think about the things that we learned in school, it either gave us a broad base of knowledge as a problem solver, or it gave us information to help us understand our world, or it gave us specific skills that we were going to be able to use on the job to run a house or an apartment and manage as a person in the community. And sometimes the academics that we learned maybe didn't seem so related to those things to us. But if you really looked behind what was supposed to be happening for those teachers that we had that were outstanding and engaged and did a good job of driving that home, they should be. And for a child with Down syndrome or a child without Down syndrome, one of the things that we know as people is that we learn best in learning communities, in groups. So the academic skills that all kids are exposed to now in for 4-year-olds, 5-year-olds, and so forth are part of teaching your child to benefit from learning in groups and benefit from learning information that will empower your child to crack the code and learn to read.
Okay.
And that opens up the world of information.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes words like academic bother me because it's such an academic word.
Yeah.
It's such an abstract word.
Mm-hmm.
And special educators may refer to something as functional academics. And usually when they say that, they mean making the academic activity really relate to the understanding that young learner has of the world and what makes sense to them. And those academics that will really prepare them directly for the world of work. It's hard to think about when your child is three.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yep, absolutely.
It just is. But we can think about what are they going to need to be successful in that learning community?
Mm-hmm.
What are they going to need to be able to benefit from the play experiences and the individual learning experiences and the group experiences in a preschool or a kindergarten setting? What is it going to take for them to communicate with other people and make friends? What is it going to take for them to, handle some of the sensory things that are going to come up for them, depending on your child's needs?
Right.
I hope that helps.
No, that makes sense. Absolutely.
Yeah. Good luck with that.
Oh, thanks.
You're welcome.
Any others that may have a question for Kathy?
Yeah, this is Melanie, and I have a question. My son is coming up for a reevaluation to be on an IEP.
Mm-hmm.
And they're actually looking at putting him on a 504.
Mm-hmm.
And my husband and I are dead set against it,
mm-hmm.
simply because he still needs speech. He's still having a hard time being, what's the word? He's still not up there academically with his peers. He doesn't measure academically. He's having a hard time with math. He still needs his para, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. And then with all his regular health needs, so on and so forth. And then plus he still goes to resource, and he goes to speech. So I'm wondering, should we still fight for him to be on an IEP, or should we just let him go with the 504?
It's hard for me to answer that because I don't have enough information, but I would... the conversation that you will have with the team, remember you're a member of the team too, to get what your son needs, should not begin with, should it be an IEP or 504, but what does this child need? This is a child with special needs or a disability. What do they need to benefit from access to that curriculum? And as you start identifying really basic needs that your son has, you may be able to show the team, or the team may discover together, that this child still really does have more needs for specialized instruction than a 504 plan would provide, perhaps. One of the things that is happening in schools across the country, including North Dakota, is that schools are using a process called response to intervention to provide students with individualized instruction without formally placing them in special education. So this is becoming more common. It started with students with learning disabilities, which is what's described in IDEA, but it's being generalized now to lots of students. And think about it this way. It used to be that teachers, general ed teachers, would teach to the middle of the class. And if they covered a subject, and if you didn't get it while they were covering it, you got left behind. And if you were really advanced, you might just be treading water. And that was kind of the old way of doing things. Now teachers, the best teachers, are diversifying instruction much more. They're really being prepared for the fact that most of the students they will ever have will be different kinds of learners and have different strengths. So to think about when they present information, that they're presenting it in multiple ways so that students who don't see as well or don't hear as well or students who have trouble remembering whatever their learning need is, how will they get the same information? And in a classroom where those kinds of things are happening, there are students with disabilities who will do extremely well. They don't need anything more. But because they have a disability, the school will want to document that and really make sure that there's a plan to ensure that their accommodations or modifications in their instruction are going to take place, and that's what the 504 plan will do. Now, in some cases, that's not going to be enough. The school systematically provides that really, really good quality of instruction, and the student still isn't making progress. In which case they're going to eventually be identified as a student who needs special education services. The difficulty comes in when your child is in a school where RTI is new and the school's ability to provide that real specialized instruction in the regular curriculum isn't well developed yet. And that makes it hard as a team to go with that because you're not sure what your child will really get. Some schools have had a lot of experience with 504 plans, and I have to tell you, I see a lot of them that are not very well written. They're not very measurable, and they're hard to hold people accountable for because of that reason. So I encourage families to make the best decision that they can for their child. If you decide to go with a 504 plan, then make sure that it is very measurable and it really spells out what your child needs. It would be my best advice. And if you truly think that your child, because you not just you have evaluations and your own observations that show that your child really needs specialized instruction, and here's why, and here's what he needs, then I would say, you know, work as a team to get him that through the IEP process. I don't know. We'd have to, if you gave me an individual call, we could talk specifically about your son, and then I could.
Yes, no problem.
Tell you more.
Thank you, Kathy.
You're welcome.
Anybody else have any questions for Kathy at all?
Kathy, this is Vicki Peterson.
Mm-hmm. Hi, Vicki.
I have a question for you. Actually, I have two. If your child participates in the North Dakota alternate assessment, they have to have short-term adaptives. Is that right?
Can you repeat that question?
Yeah, she said if a child is participating in the alternate assessment, do they have to have short-term objectives?
On their IEP. That was my understanding.
You know, Vicki, I haven't looked at those rules in a while, so you caught me off guard. But I'm glad you did because it's a good question. I think that is part of the protocol, but that doesn't mean that it's required under IDEA.
So it could be like a team's decision that they chose to write those objectives?
Right, or the way the alternate assessment protocols are set up, they're still set up around that model, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's just, you know, strictly speaking, only benchmarks are necessary. Either goals and or benchmarks are needed, not objectives under IDEA. And like I said, we forget that a lot in North Dakota. So the state may have set up the alternate assessment process to include objectives.
Okay, but not IDEA.
Right.
Okay.
As far as I know.
Okay. My next question would be for you. When you talk about the time that is allowed for a student to achieve these goals, and we're talking within a 12-month period, what if your child is having a goal, nothing that you think the goal is inappropriate or anything, but year after year is a very similar goal with the same, my son has objectives, so the same objective, and you're wondering, why are we doing this for 3 years in a row, four
right.
years in a row?
Well, and I think that does happen, and I think it's easy for teams to get into a habit of just looking at last year's goals and just wanting to tweak that. And while there's nothing wrong with that, sometimes you can lose sight of the big picture, especially if you have changes in teachers in there, that process. And so we may not really be thinking as a team about, hey, wait a minute, you know, we didn't achieve, we sort of achieved this last year, but this goal is really about the same thing. How is this going to move our child forward? And so I think you should challenge the team to take a look at that and say, I think we need to rethink this. And you can put together a little mini timeline that says, you know, 2009, this was a goal, 2010, 2011, and just pull that out for the team to highlight it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Yep, that's where that progressive part comes in.
Yeah, yeah. You know, not that I didn't think the goal was there, but, you know, if they're not mastering that in 3 years, should we still be looking at that?
Right. And I think it's hard, you know, to make decisions like that. It really gets at, well, what is my kid capable of? And what, you know, are they going to learn this concept or not? It might need be that the team needs to go back and review what strategies we're using.
And, you know, I'm sorry, there's another question. I get this mostly from other families that I help and work with, but is there any basis for, like, how many goals a child should have in school, or is,
there's,
you know,
absolutely.
Too less, or this seems too many, or...
Yeah, there's no rule about that, and... It's been my experience that, you know, writing 20 goals and then trying to keep track of all that and really expecting the teachers and the paraeducators to be focused on all of those at one time, you have to be phenomenally organized and have just a really top-notch program to do it. I think that it's better to have, say, you know, 4 or 3 or 5 broad goals, and then to have the benchmarks for those where you're just focusing on one benchmark at a time.
Probably get more questions on the opposite.
Our kids have a lot of developmental areas. So by the time you take reading, math, spelling, writing, science, you got 5 right there. And then if you add up a couple of functional things in communication and maybe a behavior, you know, you're up to 9, 10 goals just in a shot.
Yeah, I think more of the parents are talking to me saying, I only have 2 goals on my IEP.
Well, that's like a reading and a math goal?
That's, yeah. Or just two functional goals and no.
Yeah, to me, 2 functional goals is a little skimpy, but I can tell you there's nothing in IDEA that specifies
mm-hmm.
the number. It's what's appropriate for that student. So you have to go back to that present level of functioning and the assessment results and try to make a case for more.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we should be going with, you know, I'm not saying that it could never be right for a kid. We shouldn't be going with 2 goals because that's what we always do. We just do 2.
Right.
You know, I mean, you can have a student that really needs specialized instruction in just one area, and that's all they need, but I think that's less common. So how does the goal writing process go in the meetings that you guys are at?
Well, this is just, I mean, for my son, I have pretty good, I mean, I think of my IEP team as pretty exceptional. You know, I look at his goals and then, you know, just working with other families, looking at their goals, and I have to say that I'm pretty impressed. And I think with my team, I just feel like I'm actually very much a part of that goal decision, whereas some meetings that I go to, when they're talking about IEP goals, they're really not talking with the parents. They're talking amongst each other.
Mm-hmm. I've seen that happen, and I see sometimes that teachers get reinforced for that because we as parents kind of say, well, whatever, when it comes to that. We just kind of go along with it without really having a good foundation for how that works. I bet you've done a lot of work, Vicki, to read a lot of different goals and
right. It's kind of a training process for myself. So.
Yeah.
But I mean, I do see that a lot when I attend. It's like they're not really, and you know, it could be on both sides too. You know, if the parents don't understand why goals and benchmarks and stuff are needed, I would think it'd be pretty hard to advocate.
Mm-hmm. Right. Any other brave or scared people on the call that want to talk about something? Do we have any teachers on the call? No one who's going to admit it? Well, it's complicated anyway, and so I just think that teams struggle with this, and we're all doing the best that we can.
And anyone else have a question for Kathy at all? Dion, are you still on?
I think she's on. I don't have, this is Vicki again, I don't have another question, but Kathy, I do have another question, but it's mostly for you. Do you think that you'd be able to do any type of training on what response to intervention is?
Yes.
Good one, because coming up a lot more and more and more.
It is, and there's a lot of great information out there for parents. It's a learning process for schools to begin doing it. Some schools in our state are very experienced, and others are really new at it, and it takes time.
Right.
And I think we parents have to be at the table with schools as they move into that process to say what's working for our kids and to say this is an area of concern and this is, you know, oh, this felt good to me as a parent. I think this is going to work and really be part of that.
Okay. Right.
Well, Kathy, maybe that's something we can talk about for some upcoming months.
Sounds good.
Okay.
Felt like I did a lot of the talking this time, though, but hopefully there was stuff in here that you could use, and it wasn't just a review for people.
I got a lot out of it, Kathy. I appreciate it a lot. So I'm going to ask one more time if anybody has any questions at all. And don't be shy. Well, if there aren't any questions, on the last slide, Kathy gave her contact information. So make sure if you have any questions of Kathy or if you'd like her to speak with one of your groups that you may be involved in, give her a call, and maybe that's something that could be arranged. And Kathy, I appreciate your effort and all that you do for Pathfinders and the families in North Dakota, and I really appreciate you being on tonight's call. So
well, thanks, Sunny. Happy to be here and talk with everybody. Proud to know all of you.
So with that, I'll say good evening and thank you everyone for joining us tonight. So thank you.
Okay.
Bye. Bye.
The leader has disconnected. The conference will now end.